There were so many people surrounding Domi that there was no chance of pulling her Detonix pistol clear of its holster or getting the 9mm Uzi out of her coat. The tired-looking woman in the filthy clothes was grasping for her wrist again, eyeing her fingers. Domi's fist drove forward, caving the woman's nose in a burst of blood. Domi spun on her heel, surveying the mob around her. Upward of 30 people surrounded her, their feral eyes watching her closely. All of them looked emaciated, their faces sallow, their limbs thin. She doubted that any of them had much strength left, but they could overwhelm her by sheer numbers. And the leader, the woman in the red dress and tall hat, she looked pretty handy with that meat cleaver. Something glinted in the corner of Domi's vision, and she spun just in time to see a bearded man swinging an axe toward her head. The attacker stumbled as his blade unexpectedly met nothing but air. Domi thrust her left leg forward in a sweep. The rest of the crowd stepped back warily, watching the albino stranger with newfound caution. Domi leaped up from the dusty floor, holding her empty hands open for all to see.
I mean you no harm! I'm not here to hurt you! It's just a misunderstanding!
Kill the meat angel!
Kill her!
The mob closed ranks and moved toward Domi from all sides, giving her no chance to escape. Domi's gaze darted across them, trying to find a way to break through. She could see windows along one wall and a set of wide double doors toward the end of the vast room. Other than the Mattrans, that doorway was the only exit from this place. Hanging above her, attached to the ceiling, was some kind of metal hook, a big thing that had once been used to lift moored boats for repair work on the underside of their hulls. The hook was attached to some kind of mobile crane, pitted all over with orange spots of rust. As the crowd moved forward, Domi crouched, then leaped into the air like a coiled spring, her hands reaching for the hook. She grabbed it, yanking herself up as the mob reached for her, pulling herself just out of reach. She stood atop the hook, looking down at the angry mob. Their eyes and teeth glinted, along with the smattering of blades that many of them had now produced. She could go up, use the thick chain that held the hook to reach the top of the crane, and from there climb into the rafters of the high-ceiling chamber. That was a possible way to keep moving, but where would it lead her? She would still be stuck in the room, the crowd beneath her. Could she break a window and maybe get out that way? One of the crowd was shooting at her. It was time to move. Domi climbed up the chain, arms and legs wrapped around it as she pulled herself up into the dark rafters of the room. Still clinging to the chain with her knees, Domi swung her body outward and grabbed one of the wooden rafters that crisscrossed the room, pulling herself up onto it. Balanced on a rafter, she hunched into a ball, making herself as small a target as she could. Domi reached into the parka and pulled out the Uzi.
Screw this!
The crowd dispersed, running in all directions from the immediate area that Domi had targeted. She watched them scamper away, eyeing her fearfully as they backed into the shadowy corners of the vast boathouse. Domi turned to see that the woman in the hat and red dress had produced some kind of hunting rifle from who knew where. The laser targeter put a red spot on the ceiling by Domi's head as she tried to locate the albino woman through the rifle's sight. Domi ducked and began running across the thin bar of wood that she was balanced on.
Kill her! Kill the meat angel!
Suddenly, Domi slipped, her arms windmilling as she struggled to keep her balance. She recovered her footing and surveyed the crowd beneath her, trying to pick out the woman in the tall hat. Domi aimed the Uzi at the mob again.
You're called down, Minister.
But all of God's own taste heavenly. Make no mistake about that.
Domi sprinted the length of the rafter and turned as she spotted a long beam that reached toward the windows. It was light outside, early morning. A great chunk of the roof beam disappeared just as Domi was about to step onto it. Her foot trod into thin air, slipping through the gap as she overbalanced. She threw her arms out as she sailed over the edge, letting go of the Uzi as she desperately reached for something to hang on to. Her right arm wrapped around a roof beam, pulling her body after it. Domi hung there, 20 feet above the floor, as the crowd of feral cannibals circled beneath her like sharks scenting blood. General Sergei stood at the radio unit in the communications room of the Astral Factory, feeling despondent. He had been trying for 30 minutes to hail the monitoring facility in Stalingrad to no avail. It was inconceivable that no one was on monitoring duty, whatever hour of the day or night it might be there. As he sat staring at the silent radio unit, Sergei became aware that someone was watching him from the open doorway to the lightning-walled room. He turned to see Dr. Djugashvili, his face a picture of concern.
Anything, General?
I paused the sentries and asked not to be disturbed.
I told them that I needed to see you immediately concerning a personal medical matter. You have been in here for a long time, General.
It appears that there may be a fault with our communications equipment, Doctor.
You have been unable to raise headquarters?
That is correct. We will get Yuri to look at the radio set and see where the fault lies.
Listen to yourself. Excuses. After everything that the woman told us, you are making excuses. Trying to rationalize her story away as though it could not possibly be fact.
She may have sabotaged our equipment.
I do not believe that. And neither do you, General. If her story is true, then we have been stuck here in this awful, soulless place for 300 years. And we have nothing to show for it but dead colleagues and a weapon that no one has ever asked us to use. Until today.
If her story is true.
I see no reason to doubt her story, and I believe that we should now proceed forward, albeit with caution.
Yes.
General Sergei produced the Tokarev pistol from its hiding place in his lap, aiming it at Djugashvili.
With caution.
Djugashvili slumped to the floor, mouth open, clutching at the wound in his chest as his blood stained the lightning white floor of the room.
And now, Dr. Djugashvili, I shall deal with your counter-revolutionary friend for good.
Pistol in hand, he strode from the room. Still hanging from the pipes, Brigid cocked her head. Yuri turned to her.
What was that?
Gunshot.
Do you think?
Yuri, you have to help me now. You must get me down from here. Untie me.
But what
everyone's
about the general?
Life in this facility is in danger. If you do not help me now, everyone here will die.
Yuri looked at the chain that held her to the pipe. The chain was looped over the pipe and attached to a hook on the far wall at Brigid's back. It would be a simple job to free her. He glanced over his shoulder, looking for the sentries he knew were waiting just outside the door.
I do not know that this is the right thing to do, Miss Brigid.
I believe that General Sergei has just done something very, very stupid. And if you don't get me out of here, I think he'll continue doing stupid things until everyone in this facility is dead, yourself included.
Why would he do such a thing?
Please, Yuri, there's no time to discuss this. Get me down from here before...
She didn't bother to finish her sentence. The large figure of General Sergei was standing in the open doorway, flanked by the two sentries.
Do continue, kitten.
What happened?
Yuri backed away from her and stood against the wall, as far from the discussion as he could get, too terrified to push past the general and his sentries.
A little difference of opinion. Nothing to concern you.
As the general raised the pistol in his hand, Yuri cowered from the military men, pushing himself against the back wall.
Where is Dr. Djugashvili? I think that I should speak with him right now.
Sergei took a step forward, weapon pointed between Brigid's breasts, just inches from her sternum.
He is indisposed, kitten.
Did you contact your superiors, as we discussed?
That need not concern you any longer.
Brigid watched as his gray eyes narrowed infinitesimally. The general was about to pull the trigger. Brigid moved, pulling herself upward from her pendulum position and kicking her legs out before her, knocking the gun. The twin sentries lifted their Fedorov pistols as General Sergei regained his position and swung the pistol back toward her, targeting her face as she dangled at the end of the chain. The general pulled the trigger for a second time, but Brigid's face disappeared from his line of sight and she dropped to the floor. Yuri, she realized, had unhooked the chain once he had eased himself, unnoticed, to the back of the interrogation room. She was on the floor now, wrists still clamped together. She kicked upward, driving the toes of both boots into the general's groin.
Cease fire! Cease fire!
Brigid rolled to her knees and swept her bound hands outward, flicking the long chain cord like a whip. She spun to her feet, glancing behind her to make sure that Yuri was still safe at the back of the room. As she whipped around to her attackers once more, Brigid's left leg stretched out, booting the general full in the face with a weak but effective roundhouse kick. She used the energy to kick off from the floor, driving forward with her shoulder down, right elbow pointing outward. She had to disarm this psychopath. That was the first priority, and after that, she had to disarm the others and get a gun for herself. It was insanity. She was tired, still bound by the chain, and three armed enemies were just a shout away. General Sergei was on the floor, the Tokarev pistol out of his hands, but within his reach.
Don't move, or I shoot!
She ignored the sentry, quickly scrambling across the floor for Sergei's handgun. The gun was in her hands, pointing at the sentries.
You are both going to be as still as statues because my patience has totally run out!
Both sentries stopped moving, looks of abject terror on their faces.
Yuri, are you there?
Yes, Miss Bridget, I'm here.
You got any leaks? Any blood?
No.
Good. I need you to disarm these gentlemen.
Sergei began to shift beneath her, struggling back to his senses, and Bridget cold-cocked him with the gun. Then she trained the pistol on the two soldiers again.
Don't either of you try to be clever now.
As Yuri took their auto rifles from them, another figure walked into the doorway, and Bridget saw that it was Dr. Djugashvili. He seemed to be limping more profoundly than before, and when Bridget glanced at him momentarily, she realized that he was clutching his chest, his hand red with blood.
Doctor, what happened?
The general had some trouble raising headquarters. Exactly as you suggested.
Are you... what happened?
I fear we do not have long.
Bridget looked at him properly then. His face was drawn and pale, and a fine mist was floating from his skin, hair, and clothes. Where his hair had been dark with gray streaks, it now seemed as though it was made of water vapor, gradually evaporating in a misty halo around his head.
What happened to you?
Bridget made her way toward him, the gun still trained on the disarmed sentries. As she got closer, she saw that his skin was breaking up, as though he were constructed of little flakes stitched together. When she glanced down at his white coat, shirt, and tie, she saw the same thing was happening there, too.
The general shot me.
Behind her, Yuri used another chain to tie up the sentries.
But what?
This place.
Djugashvili nodded sagely, untying the chain that held Bridget's wrists together.
Come. We have little time left.
Bridget followed Djugashvili out of the room, with Yuri trailing behind her, carrying a Fedorov rifle under each arm. The sleek, bronze-hued Manta soared through the air toward the Black Sea. Sitting at the controls, Grant studied the heads-up display as he banked in a wide arc toward Poti, dipping below the clouds. The shells of buildings jutted into the sky like fangs, and the tarmac roads were overgrown with grass and weeds. As Grant brought the Manta lower, he spotted the group of buildings that had once served as a Soviet naval base. They were dilapidated now, smashed windows and missing chunks from their roofs and walls. According to the sensors, Domi was in the largest building in the complex. Winking steadily on the visual overlay inside Grant's helmet, her transponder signal would guide him to her. Clinging to the roof beam, Domi watched as the townspeople circled below, their keen eyes urging her sylph-like body to fall.
I want her toes!
Wait! Look at her delicious long legs!
I'm going to eat the angel's face! I'm going to drink her eyes!
Domi forced her grip on the beam to tighten as she tried to pull herself back up, but it was an impossible task from that angle. The woman with the tall hat was holding her sniper rifle loosely in her hands now, confident that Domi was about to lose her grip.
Come on, angel. Come down and feed us.
Domi swung her body around, letting go of the beam for a fraction of a second, and dropping 2 inches before she grasped the beam once more, this time with both hands. She pulled herself up, getting her chest over the beam before resting against it, the weight on her stomach, her legs still dangling over the side.
She tried to fly, I think.
Shoot her down.
The woman in the hat rested the butt of the sniper rifle against her shoulder and took aim once again. Domi vaulted onto the roof beam. She looked to the line of windows, still halfway across the vast room from her current position, crouching on the thin beam. Domi unzipped her coat and reached in for the Detonix Combat Master 45 that she wore at her shoulder. Swiftly, she popped her head over the edge of the rafter and located the woman with the sniper rifle before whipping her head back. Domi flipped over so that she was resting flat on the beam, her right arm dangling over the side, Combat Master in hand. She sighted the woman in the hat. The leader in the ornate red dress dropped her sniper rifle and reached up to the sides of her head as her hat slipped and blood began to pour down her forehead. As the woman fell to the floor, Domi started to select more targets. Those with ballistic weapons were the first priority. The knife wielders could wait. She drew her arm back behind the wooden shield of the roof beam. Domi realized that the beam had lost integrity and would split or snap if she didn't remove her weight shortly. Her ruby eyes scanned both ends of the roof beam and the area all around it. There was a crossbeam about 10 feet away from where she was. The crossbeam looked relatively undamaged and capable of supporting her weight. Lifting herself up like a cat, arched, Domi rolled to her feet, her left arm out to steady her. She sprinted along the thin beam, 1 foot directly in front of the other. She leaped the corner gap to the crossbeam, avoiding the incoming rocket. Smoke clogged the air from the rocket, and the ceiling above where the missile hit was now on fire, a small circle of red-orange flames flickering to life.
Domi, do you copy? Say again, do you copy?
Grant! This is Domi, I read you!
Domi, I'm just over the Poti naval base in the mantle. My display says you're inside, is that right?
I think so!
There's a wide skirt of concrete here that I can land on. Southeast corner of the complex. Think you can get there?
Domi leaped from the beam she was running along. She took to the air and landed on a parallel beam, struggling for a moment to keep from toppling.
I'm in what looks like a ship repair center, but I'm having a little trouble.
What kind of trouble?
Hungry locals mistook me for dinner. Now they're trying to flambé me with a rocket launcher.
Crap. I'm bringing the Manta down now. What do you need me to do?
Hang tight, and I'll come find you. And Grant, keep the engine running, okay?
Roger that.
Neverwalk sat in the sand, watching the emaciated goats and sucking on a pebble as he waited for his next instruction. The first dreamwalk had proved a strain for Goodfather, and he had needed to sit down on a little outcropping to catch his breath. Until he was ready, the strike team had to wait. Badfather was standing over Goodfather, speaking softly to him, words that didn't carry to Neverwalk's position. As he watched, Goodfather pushed hard against the gnarled walking cane and got back to his feet, dismissing Badfather's proffered hand.
We are ready.
Ruckstreaming closed the lid of his laptop.
Their communications are veiled. They suspect tempering.
Do they know anything about us?
They have not identified the source of their woes yet, Badfather.
Will they?
I cannot adjust the coding while we are in the dreaming. If they were to crack it now, there is a possibility.
What possibility?
Hard to say, but I suggest we keep moving while we still have the advantage of surprise.
Agreed.
During the stopover in Africa, Cloud Singer had etched out twin circles in the sand with the end of her pole, mirroring those at the edge of their tribal village in Australia. Goodfather took up his position in the smaller circle while the other warriors gathered around Badfather in the larger disc. Goodfather whipped the bull roarer above his head, spinning it to begin the long ululation. Domi's arms pumped as she ran the final 15 feet of the roof beam. The bank of windows was ahead of her now, and she raised her detonics pistol toward the central panes of glass.
She's making a run for it, trying to fly back to heaven!
Kill her! Don't let our angel meet escape!
Domi turned her head back, pulling the fur-lined hood of the parka over her head with her left hand as she dived through the shattered window.
Huh?
The crossbars of the window frame came with her, and she fell toward the ground 15 feet below. Shoving the hood back, Domi turned, the Detonics Combat Master up and ready, like an extension of her arm, pointing at the building she had just exited. She could see flames licking at the holes made by the rockets. As she watched, three heads appeared in the windows as her pursuers tried to clamber out. The other two ducked back down out of sight. A crowd of armed townspeople ran after her. They kept coming, waving knives and axes that twinkled in the morning sunlight. Domi spun, launching into a run straight from her crouch, the pistol still clutched in her right hand. She looked up at the sky to locate the sun, heading in its direction to find Grant and the Manta. There was a huge, dirty white building running right up to the sea, and Domi dashed toward it. As she reached the corner of the building, she tripped and fell to the hard concrete. Lying there, Domi turned to push herself upright, and she saw that the lead cannibals were only a dozen paces away. She took careful aim with the detonics. The crowd stopped for a moment, unsure what to do. Domi pointed the gun at a mustached man in ragged, blood-soiled clothes as he stepped forward, wielding a sledgehammer in his hands. Domi leaped from the ground and sprinted away from the group, head down, arms pumping. The crowd was just behind her now. Domi felt something then, the brush of a hand, as someone reached for the bouncing hood of the parka.
I have her!
Domi twisted to elude his grasp and looked up to see the familiar bronze metal shape of the Manta as she rounded the far side of the large white building. Relief soared through her, relief and joy as she recognized Grant sitting in the cockpit, the hatch open and pushed back. He held a long shaft of black metal in his hand, his Copperhead subgun. Domi threw herself on the rock-hard ground, rolling to take the impact on her left shoulder. Grant unleashed a storm of 4.85mm steel-jacketed death into the mob. Domi put her arms over her head, covering her ears as the slugs drilled into the startled crowd of hungry killers. Grant scanned the horizon, spotting more people running their way.
You want a lift?
Domi rose from the ground and jogged toward the Manta, She smiled at him, ruby-red eyes catching the sun's rays.
Hell yeah!
Grant waited, copperhead poised, as Domi leaped into the seat behind his.
You okay, Domi?
Yeah. Just let's get out of here, okay?
Grant quickly ran through the pre-flight sequence.
Seemed like a friendly bunch.
Bastards wanted to eat me alive! You believe that?
Yeah, you've got to learn to choose your friends better.
The strike team stepped out of the dreaming and found itself in a forest in the mountains. Its members spread out, weapons at the ready, checking their surroundings warily. Neverwalk stayed close to Goodfather as he leaned against the walking stick and kept to the shadows. Cloudsinger and Rabbit in the Moon rushed ahead to check that the area was secure. Ahead of them, Neverwalk could see a clearing and a single-story building, just a box, really, built of concrete with slit windows all around. Over the far side of the building were more trees, and just before them was a wide, sleek, metallic object, finished in a glistening bronze that glowed like fire in the rays of the early morning sun. Neverwalk recognized it from the Vela-class satellite feed as one of the vehicles that the Cerberus people had traveled there in.
Good Father, look! One of their vehicles is missing.
Good Father looked to where Neverwalk was pointing, nodding when he noticed the lone metal-shelled craft sitting there.
What does it mean?
Good Father held a finger to his lips.
Shh!
Rabbit in the Moon dashed back to the others, his compound bow in one hand.
The area is clear. No one is around.
Badfather stroked his beard thoughtfully as he looked around the clearing at the overgrown road.
They spoke of a burrow beneath our feet.
Cloudsinger was at the end of the blacktop opposite the low concrete building. The road was shaped like a hangman's noose there, a little circle for turning large vehicles, and an old rusty truck was parked at a lurch, its wheels rotted through.
Here!
She pointed to a patch of weed-covered ground at her feet. The team jogged across to look, and Cloudsinger gestured to a wide circular grill of rusty bars, partly obscured by the undergrowth. On one side of the circle was a space where a large hole had been cut and a thin cord snaked from the hole, going into the grass until it attached to a climber's piton that had been driven into the ground.
They came this way. Do we follow?
Good Father unhooked the bull roarer from his belt and looked to Bad Father and Rabbit in the Moon.
We'll get there through the dreaming.
The two navigators agreed with nods. The five of them gathered around Good Father, forming a rough circle as the bull roarer gathered speed above his head. After a tingling of the implants at the base of their necks, they all emerged in real world. In this instance, real world was a close-walled tunnel, almost entirely dark apart from a light source shining from a rectangular opening at the far end. As one, the strike team called on the electrochemical polymer lenses that appeared over their eyes on nictitating membranes. And suddenly, the corridor was revealed to them clearly, as though well lit.
Silent now. We're in the lap of the enemy.
Neverwalk watched as Cloudsinger and Rockstreaming moved ahead, warily checking the open doors to the left and right of them. Kane had found a locker in the far end of the bunk room and was running the beam of his microlight over the contents. Books and magazines, personal letters stuffed in old envelopes. Suddenly, he cocked his head. He stepped away from the locker and made his way back to the open doorway of the room, covering the beam of the microlight with his hand. He waited by the door, listening. He had heard something, just for a second. The place was beginning to get to him. He drew his hand away from the front of the microlight. He was sure that his mind wasn't playing tricks on him. His point man sense was damn sure of that, even if his conscious rational mind was trying to deny it. Kane doused the beam and placed his dark glasses with the electrochemical polymer lenses back over his eyes, granting himself artificial night vision in the dark complex. Silently, he paced toward the door. Once he reached the doorway, he pushed his back against the wall and listened for sounds in the corridor beyond. There were at least two people, quietly moving along the corridor. Warily, Kane leaned forward and popped his head around the doorframe for a fraction of a second, peeking down the length of the corridor with the polymer lenses over his eyes, creating light where there was darkness. His head whipped back behind the door jamb, eyes closed as he assessed what he had seen. There was a group at the far end of the narrow corridor. Kane couldn't say how many, but not more than 10, maybe as few as 3. Crouching, he leaned against the door, his wrist tendons flexing to bring the Sin Eater into the palm of his hand. Then he popped his head out once more, looking up the corridor and assessing the situation. There were 6 of them. One of them was a woman, leading the others, a stick or pole in her hand. Next to her was a man, a long coat similar to Grant's billowing behind him, some kind of bent blade in his hand. Kane ducked back again, looking around for another exit that he knew wasn't there, just an instinctive reaction to being trapped as the strangers approached. The weight of the Sin-Eater pistol in his hand was just another part of Kane's body, not even a consideration in his mind. But he looked at it then, and he thought of Bridget Baptiste, three doors away from him and lost in meditation. Diplomacy, Kane reminded himself, stepping into the corridor and preparing to introduce himself. He flicked on the microlight beam and waved it along the corridor, hoping he hadn't blinded anyone.
Hello?
Before Kane realized what was happening, an arrow hit his flashlight. Darkness flooded the corridor again as a second shaft flew toward him.
Looks like negotiations are over.
Kane raised the Sin Eater. Bridget Baptiste turned to Dr. Djougashvili as they rushed down the pure white corridor toward the main room of the astral complex. Yuri followed behind them. The lab assistant had slung one of the rifles over his shoulder by its strap, and he hefted the other in his hands, poised to shoot anyone who followed them.
We must launch the death cry.
The soldiers will never let us do such a thing, Doctor.
We must convince them.
Bridget shoved the Tokarev into her hip holster, where it seemed to overlay, then replace the ghostly image of the TP-9.
Yuri, hand me a rifle.
Yuri passed the one that he held to her, then shrugged the other from his shoulder and rested it in his hands while she covered their advance.
We don't have much time.
Why not? What's going to happen?
I won't be here to help you for very long.
What do you mean?
She glanced at him before turning her attention back to the corridor ahead of them. Djougashvili seemed to be disintegrating. Flecks of his face were blowing away, rising into the air like the embers of a wood fire before disappearing into nothingness. A mist of washed-out black billowed from his head where his hair had once been, and his limbs seemed to smolder, billowing like smoke as he swung them to march onward.
I don't understand. What's happening to you?
Do you remember what I told you about Lenya Krylov?
You told me she was shot, that she became a mist, a fog before your eyes. You're not... You can't be.
General Sergei shot me in the chest. I think perhaps he has clipped my heart.
How can this be? How can guns work here? How can they even exist here?
Lenya was quite brilliant. She deduced a way to bring solid items here. Our files, the materials we would need to work on the death cry itself. Quite brilliant.
And so she brought the guns?
Soldiers do not travel without guns, Miss Baptiste. It was a prerequisite of the project before we could even begin working in this astral factory.
But what happens to your consciousness? When you die, I mean.
That is a question that has taxed minds far superior to mine or yours, I suspect.
Bridget realized that up until now, albeit subconsciously, she had been treating this like a dream. An incredibly vivid, detailed, and downright painful dream, but a dream just the same. Something that she could wake up from. Seeing the doctor breaking apart as they spoke made her acknowledge there was something fundamentally wrong with her assumption. That if she was killed here, perhaps she wouldn't simply wake up and try all over again like some character in a video game. The three of them reached the end of the corridor, and Bridget peeked out at the colossal weapon that dominated the vast white-walled room. She counted 9 soldiers there, including Kremenzov, who had subjected her to that sadistic beating in the interrogation room. There were a dozen white-coated laboratory assistants going about their business at the hull or shell of the huge weapon itself. Bridget turned back to the others.
How does the weapon work, Doctor? Is there a control panel? Do we launch it, or do we get inside it like a vehicle?
We need to be inside the Death Cry to move it to the corporeal world. Once there, we can unleash its scream at a single designated target.
Scream? What the hell does this thing do?
It obliterates life with surgical precision.
Face hidden in the pilot's helmet, Grant suddenly shook his head.
Oh, no, no, no.
Domi was sitting behind him in the cockpit of the Manta.
What is it?
They were swooping through a range of mountains now, beautiful, pristine territory that reminded Domi of the wilds around the Cerberus Redoubt, where she would often go hunting.
I just did a scan of the underground bunker, Project Chernobog. Shows 8 bodies beneath the surface. Warm bodies. Living folks.
Kane, Bridget, plus 6 mean Russians who just thawed out?
Don't know who they are, but I'm gonna go out on a limb and say they are trouble with a capital T. Probably a capital R, too.
Below, Domi could see a small track of road, and snuggled between the trees at its edge, another Manta aircraft.
Someone systematically altered the feed data that Cerberus received on this operation. These people could have been waiting right outside, unseen by the satellite, just out of sight, waiting for you to leave before they made their move.
Exactly. A whole pot roast of trouble.
He brought down the Manta, bumping it on the ground.
Keep your eyes open, Domi. We're going in.
Kane popped into the corridor, holding the Sin Eater, deliberately aiming it over the heads of the newcomers. So far as he could see, they didn't even flinch, which told him a couple of things. These people were fantastically aware of their surroundings, and they were exceptionally disciplined warriors, despite appearances to the contrary. Kane ducked back into the bunk room. He stood with his back to the wall, the Sin Eater held high, ready for the next attack.
If you people weren't sure, those were meant as warning shots. Now, I'm certain that if we all talk about this, we can figure out some kind of agreement to our mutual benefit. What do you say?
You are to hand over the weapon, the death cry, to us. That's the beginning and the end of the negotiation.
I'm going to have to say negative to that request on account of my not actually having the death cry.
One of your people has it, Cerberus man. You will place your gun on the floor now, and you will provide us with access to the death cry immediately.
Whoever they were, they knew that Kane's crew were representatives of Cerberus, and furthermore, that the death cry had already been accessed by Baptiste. As Kane pondered his next move, Grant came through on the contact.
You reading me, buddy? With Domi.
Say again. Didn't receive your full transmission, Grant. Please say again.
Having rappelled down the climbing cord, Grant stood in the sludge and muck of the ventilation shaft waiting for Domi.
Again. Receive your full transmission, Grant. Please say again.
I said me and Domi are coming down the shaft now. We'll be with you in under a minute. You copy?
Copy that. I've got some company down.
Yeah, we know.
At his side, Domi freed her Detonic's combat master from its holster.
You ready to do this?
They might be friendly.
Law of averages on that one?
Yeah, but let's try not to get kill crazy unless and until, okay?
Hell, Grant, you take the fun out of everything.
Donald Bry stood beside Lakesh's chair in the center of the Cerberus operations room and handed him a paper report of roughly 24 pages.
For your attention, Lakesh.
Summarize it for me, Donald.
We've managed to break the coding on the hack, and control of the satellite feed is now back in-house.
Bry pointed to an unmanned screen that showed a live feed of a clutch of islands in the Pacific.
Skylar's just retooling the feeds from the transponders now, bypassing the errant code that had masked them. We've cracked it.
Good work. Can you call up a live image from the Caucasus Mountains? I want to check on our field team right away.
The satellite's repositioning as we speak. Is there anything else?
Communication, security. And where did this hack originate, do we know?
We think it's Australia, but we haven't been able to triangulate it as yet. As for communication security, my team is still working on that. Hope to have a solution in 3 to 4 hours.
With that, Donald Bry strode over to the unmanned communications desk and resumed his regular position behind the monitor.
Donald, once the field team is back safely, I want you to get a good 8 hours sleep before I see you back in that seat again.
Once the team is back, you won't be able to stop me.
Lakesh smiled, feeling content and safe once more. The crisis was not over yet, but it felt somehow like the major problems had been solved or sidestepped. He rose from his seat and joined Reba DeFore and Skylar Hitch as they examined the new feed data from the transponders. Kane looked at his Sin Eater, considered the arrows that had been fired at him even before he had spoken, considered the fragile state of Bridget Baptiste 2 doors away from him, and decided that negotiating with these people was off the agenda.
If you want to stop shooting arrows at me, I'll happily discuss the situation. But if you won't do that, I'm obliged to tell you that I'm fully prepared to disable or kill you people if necessary. Consider that fair warning. What the hell is that?
Kane sidestepped, pushing his body flat to the wall, and swung his gun arm out into the corridor, his head peeking past the open doorway. 2 figures were running down the corridor toward him, their heads low as they rushed forward. The first was a trim, dark-skinned woman dressed in strips of cloth and carrying a long, thin shaft. The strips of cloth were light against her dark skin, and thick, braided hair swung over her shoulders in a peacock-like spread. The second was a man, also dark-skinned, tall, and with a muscular, athletic physique. The man's long coat billowed around him as he rushed forward. The man appeared to have some kind of curved blade in his hand, and as Kane watched, he tossed it in his direction from 30 feet away. As it passed the brightly lit doorway of the Cheka office, Kane confirmed it wasn't a blade at all. It was a metal boomerang. The boomerang clipped against the back wall of the corridor before whipping back along its approach path and into the waiting palm of the long-coated thrower. His head back outside the doorway, Kane saw that his shots had missed both parties, and without consciously thinking, he aimed again at the man and the woman as they closed the gap. The bullets raced along the corridor straight into the two of them, but incredibly, they were no longer there. Kane blinked, wondering if his night vision lenses were damaged, giving him a false impression of the situation in the darkened corridor. But no, there they were again, five steps closer than before, as though they had been there all along. Kane held down the guardless trigger of the Sin Eater, unleashing a long stream of bullets as he sprayed the corridor before him in a chest-high left-to-right arc. The approaching pair of warriors disappeared once more. Perplexed, Kane held the Sin Eater steady on the corridor before him. He thought that maybe he was in a meditation state like Baptiste. Maybe all of this was a dream. People don't just disappear. As he thought that, Kane saw the man reappear right in front of him, standing in a semi-crouch and thrusting the heel of his palm against the barrel of the Sin Eater. His knees caught the lower bunk bed behind him. The man in the long coat had followed him into the room, swinging his boomerang at Kane's face and chest like a knife. Kane was in the bunk with a skeleton, below the swinging, sharp-edged boomerang, and kicked out with his left foot, catching his attacker with a glancing blow to the gut. The man danced backward, moving with the momentum of Kane's kick so as to retain perfect balance. Kane pushed himself up. The woman was in the room now, too, holding the pole in a fighter's stance, her eyes focused on Kane despite the darkness of the room. She disappeared again, winking out of existence, out of his line of fire. And now the man was upon him again, sweeping the long tails of his coat at Kane's face to distract him, and following through with a backward thrust of the hand holding the boomerang. A shallow cut opened on his cheek as the boomerang passed. As soon as they had descended to the lowest part of the ventilation shaft, Grant and Domi placed their dark glasses over their eyes and switched to night vision mode, letting the lenses gather and amplify all the available light. Grant placed the Copperhead subgun on the sill of the shaft as he lowered himself, feet first, through the vent that gave access to the underground complex.
Didn't these Russians believe in fucking doors?
There's one entrance and they bricked it up.
Grant disappeared through the gap. His hand reached back for the Copperhead.
Clear.
The waif-like albino woman crouched on the edge of the sill and slipped through the gap like a sheet of paper disappearing through the gap beneath the door. A moment later, Detonic's combat master in hand, she was standing at Grant's side in an unlit room full of dead machinery. Grant indicated Domi's pistol.
You bring anything bigger?
Had an Uzi submachine gun, but I fed it to my hungry friends back in Poti. Well, you know what they say. It's not the size of the gun that matters.
No, it is.
Grant took a two-handed grip on the two-foot-long copperhead.
Otherwise, I'd have come here armed with a blowpipe and spitballs.
With that, he stalked up to the open door with Domi at his heels. When he reached the door, he stopped, gun held high.
What's that noise?
Whirly bird?
Can't be. On three?
Domi nodded, then did a silent countdown in front of them with her free hand. When her ring finger appeared, Grant rushed into the corridor, copperhead leveled, with Domi a step behind him and to his right. There were four people standing there, directly in front of them. Closest to them was a man of a similar build to Domi. He had dark skin and scraggly hair and was likely still in his teens. Behind him, an older man stood with his hand over his head, spinning some kind of object at the end of a cord. It was the object that was making the strange noise that bled through the complex. Another older man stood farther along the corridor, his back to Grant and Domi. Beside the second older man stood a younger man with an athletic build and wearing a tattered jacket of different shades. He held a large bow in his hands, sighting along it down to the far end of the long corridor, away from Grant and Domi.
I want everyone to freeze right where they are, unless they want to taste 700 rounds a minute.
As Domi watched, the four men turned as one, and the young man who was closest to her and Grant flicked his wrist almost casually. Domi saw the circle whip out from his hand, not much larger than the boy's fist, speeding toward Grant on the end of a string. Before Grant could react, the object spun around the nose of his copperhead gun, whipping around it with a cord trailing behind. Yeah. Grant was yanked forward as the gun was pulled violently from his hands, blocking Domi's line of fire for a crucial few seconds.
Grant, get down!
The man with the compound bow spun and leaped in their direction, loosing an arrow at them as he did so. Domi arched backward, aiming her Detonic's combat master at the bone. Unharmed, the man continued his leap, landing before Grant and holding the bow in one hand as he drew back the other for a punch. The huge X-Mag swerved to avoid the blow and backhanded the man across the face. He then followed up with a swinging left hook. The tattooed bowman deflected the punch with the arch of the tungsten bow. Grant continued his attack, jabbing with his right fist as the bowman weaved out of his way. Suddenly, the bowman was upon him once more, the open palm of his left hand reaching out to slap Grant high on the chest in a seemingly effete gesture. The tattooed warrior stepped back, a malicious grin on his face. Behind him, the whole corridor had disappeared, replaced with some kind of open, windswept plain. Grant looked around, wondering what had happened as the man literally disappeared before his eyes. Still in the corridor, Domi watched Grant and the warrior in the shabby jacket wink out of existence. Less than a second later, as Domi's mind was still trying to make sense of what she had just seen, the man reappeared, but Grant was gone, nowhere to be seen. Something freaky just happened, Domi realized. She aimed the Detonic's combat master again. It was only a narrow corridor. He didn't have much space to avoid her, but he ducked beneath her shots and through an open doorway to Domi's left. As she rushed forward to follow him, the teenage boy with the yo-yo flipped his wrist. She spun back, realizing that she was outnumbered and needed to whittle down the enemies as swiftly and systematically as possible. As she did so, one of the old men launched a yo-yo of his own at her, and Domi balked. His weapon was larger than the boy's, like two metal saucers on an axle. Domi ducked as the spinning metal blades ripped toward her and watched as they hurtled at the wall behind her. Kane swung his left fist toward the boomerang man's face, but as the punch was about to connect, he was suddenly struck by something solid in the back of his legs. Kane looked back as he tried to right himself. The woman was there again, wielding the stick like a bow staff, holding it in one hand as she waited for his next move. This close, she looked young, her face unlined, her mostly bare body dotted with tattoos. Kane got up from the floor on one knee, pulling himself back to a standing position.
I don't want to hurt you, either of you.
You're not going to.
Kane lifted the Sin Eater to point at her again.
We could talk about this, or you and your pal could keep out racing bullets until, you know, you don't.
Kane was aware that the other warrior, the man in the duster with the boomerang, was standing a few feet behind him.
Why don't you just hand over the astral weapon? Save yourself a lot of hassle.
Like I already said, I don't have it.
The woman in the strips of cloth swung the staff at Kane's legs, just missing his groin. But again, the bullets didn't hit. The woman was already gone, with no hint of her ever having been there. From Kane's right, the man swung the razor-sharp boomerang at his face again. The man's other arm swung toward him then, and Kane saw that he had a second metal boomerang in that hand, just as sharp as the first. Kane skipped back along the rows of bunk beds, ducking and weaving out of the way of the man's lunging attack. As he did so, Kane analyzed the situation. Guns were useless. These people either moved too fast or they were hollow projections with solid aspects. Grant had checked every one of the 12 rooms in that Soviet underground bunker, but this place was nothing like anything he had seen there. It felt empty, a dead place full of nothing. As he looked around, he saw someone appear a little way from him, just popping into existence from nowhere, no discernible door opening to facilitate entry. It was a woman, dark-skinned and dressed in white strips like bandages, about 40 feet ahead of him, roughly the distance to the canteen and bunk room, if he'd still been in the complex. Grant ran toward her.
Hello? Hello, miss!
The woman turned to him, arms outstretched, keeping her center of balance low like a martial artist. She had a pole in one hand, a thin stick that was almost as long as she was tall. Now just 10 feet away, Grant held his hands up, showing her that they were empty, and he slowed his approach to a walking pace.
I'm not going to hurt you. You have any idea where we are?
She pivoted then, ducking low and lunging with the pole.
Welcome to your eternity, Cerberus man.
Anger rising, Grant looked up, but the woman was already gone. Kane glanced over his shoulder, aware that he was rapidly approaching the rear wall of the room. There was an air duct up there, attached somehow to the big ventilation shaft that ran above the installation, its wire grill silted up with more than 200 years of muck and dust. Kane concluded he couldn't shoot these people, but he could still shoot everything else. With that, he swung the Sin Eater toward the grill. Kane held his breath and dropped aside. Dust and sludge spurted out of the broken vent, bursting forth and spilling into the face and upper body of Kane's boomerang-wielding attacker. The man wiped at his eyes with the back of his hand automatically, his attention diverted. As he stumbled across the tiled floor, Kane lunged forward, tackling the man full across the abdomen and plowing both of them to the floor. Kane drew back his empty left hand and made a fist.
Disappear from this. Be thankful I didn't shoot you.
Kane stepped away from the unconscious man and shook dirt from his hair. As he did so, the woman reappeared, her face a mask of intensity as she watched her foe from just inside the doorway.
So, are we gonna negotiate or are we gonna fight?
The young woman looked perplexed for a moment, a frown crossing her brow. Then, without a word, she rushed forward, whipping her staff at Kane's face as he danced backward out of reach. As the staff continued through its arc, Kane's left hand darted out and grabbed it, stopping it with a sudden jolt. Still holding the other end of the long shaft, Kane raised the Sin-Eater toward her as he clung to the near end of the staff, muscles flexing as he pulled the girl to him. Cloudsinger saw the muzzle of the gun rising toward her face, and she let go of the staff and lunged backward, kicking out as she flew through the air. Her heel knocked the gun aside, but no shots were fired. Her opponent was holding back.
Do you think we're playing? You had an opportunity to shoot me, and yet you let it slip through your fingers.
Yeah, I could have shot your partner too, but I'm trying to give you a chance to reconsider things before I wind up having to kill you.
You're a fool, Cerberus man.
Cloudsinger activated her implant once more and stepped into the dreaming. She sprinted across the open plain, noting that the other Cerberus man, the one with the dark mustache, was just getting up off the shale-covered ground behind her. Then the implant at the base of her neck fired once more. She was back in the bunk room, 7 steps from where she had been 2 seconds earlier, behind Kane, wrapping her left arm around his throat.
What the...
A moment ago, she had been standing in front of him, and yet now she was behind him, putting pressure on his windpipe in a seemingly impossible surprise attack. As she held him, she pivoted, and suddenly her knee slammed repeatedly into his side. She was trying to use his own weight to snap his neck. He keeled over, crashed on one knee, and clawed at her grasp with his left hand. With his other hand, the one holding the Sin-Eater, Kane pointed behind him, trying to locate her. Her arm darted out, knocking the weapon aside. Kane tried to roll forward, pulling the girl's arm away from him with as much strength as he could muster. Suddenly, she let go. He lost his balance and slumped toward the floor, skidding on one knee. For a moment, dark spots raced across his vision, and he blinked them away as he got up, swinging the Sin-Eater back at the woman. Or at least, where she had been. She was gone, leaving just Kane and her partner's unconscious form in a room full of skeletons.